Beruchim Abayim Rabotai. Welcome to another edition of our Wednesday night class. Tonight's lesson will be studied for the Fu'asher Ema of Asher Daniel ben Rivka. El narefana lo, el narefana lo, el narefana lo, betuch she'ar chole amo Yisrael, ve'emru amen. We are studying Parashat Vayechi, the last Parashah in Sefer Bereshit. The Parashah where Yaakov Avinu gives his last will and testament to his children and grandchildren. Tonight, with your permission, I'd like to analyze an event that takes place in the beginning of the Parashah, when Yosef HaSadiq brings his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, to their grandfather in order to receive the blessing. The Pasuk writes, Ve'enei Yisrael kavedu mizoken. It says, Yaakov Avinu, his eyes became weak, lo yuchal lirot. He lost his vision towards the end of his life. Vayagesh otam elav, so Yosef brings his children towards Yaakov. Vayishak lahem, he kisses them. Vayhabek lahem, he hugs them. Then Yaakov reacts and says, I didn't think I was ever going to see you again. Yosef, I thought you were gone. Now I have the zechut not only to see you, but to see your grandchildren. This is a extra special, extra credit. Vayikach Yosef et shenem, so he takes his two sons, et Ephraim bimino misemol Yisrael, vet Menashe bismolo mimin Yisrael. So he positions his children in order to make it easy for his father. He puts Menashe, the Bechor, to the right of Yaakov, and he puts Ephraim to the left. Our tradition tells us that when one blesses his children, you bless with the right hand. The right hand is always the primary hand. If you're blessing two children simultaneously, usually you'd put the right hand on the firstborn, because the firstborn, the Bechor, has extra status. And on the younger one, you'd put the left hand as the secondary beracha. So in order to make it easier for Yaakov, Yosef prepositions the children, Menashe to the right, Ephraim to the left, Menashe being the Bechor, in order that Yaakov just can extend his hands and place his right on the Bechor and his left on the second son. But it doesn't work out as planned. Vayishlach Yisrael et yemino vayashet al rosh Ephraim vehu asair ve'etzemolo al rosh Menashe. Yaakov Avinu crisscrosses his hands and he puts the right hand on Ephraim and he puts the left hand on Menashe, and the Torah explains it, sikelet yadav. He maneuvered his hands, ki Menashe Bechor, because Menashe is the firstborn. I'd like to analyze these words for a second. Before we go further, what does it mean, sikelet yadav? There's a very important commentary on the Torah called Targum Unkelus. This is a very important translation because it was given at Sinai with the Torah. The official translation of the Torah is the Aramaic translation of Unkelus. Therefore, it's very, very vital when one reads the Pasuk, if you want to get a clear translation, to read the Targum. The problem is many of us are not fluent in Aramaic. Therefore, we struggle through it. But if one reads it, you'll find a lot of very important insights that shed light on the Pasuk. In this case, the Targum says, Sikel et yadav. So it interprets it, Ach keminun lidohi. What does it mean? Achkeminun? Achkeminun comes from the word hacham. Targum is trying to tell us Yaakov knew what he was doing. He did it besechel. He did it with intellect. Don't think that this was an old man that got flustered, and God forbid, from senility, that he was confused. He just put his hands out, and he didn't know exactly who he was holding. Targum says, his hands were placed there by design. Yaakov Abinu had full faculties to the end. As we see when he blesses his 12 children, the Shevatim, if you study those blessings of the 12 Shevatim, they are the most insightful prophecies that Yaakov Abinu had moments before his demise. So you see he had clarity and full intelligence to the end. So you shouldn't think when Menashe and Ephraim were there and he puts the crisscross, you shouldn't say, oh, this is an old man over here that's bewildered. The Targum comes on and says, Achkeminun lidohi, his hands were placed with chokmah. It was done intentionally. I heard a question that some of the Mefarshim ask, why did Yaakov have to crisscross his hands? He could have just told his children or grandchildren to switch positions. He could have told Menashe, do me a favor, I want you to stand to my left, Ephraim, come to my right. I mean, he has both options. He can crisscross his hands, or he could, just tell the children to switch positions. So to that I saw Noam Elimelech, Rabbi Elimelech Milizinsk. He holds that he didn't want to embarrass anybody over here. Because it seems when the grandchildren came to get the blessings, they come in front of their grandfather with their head down. So they have no idea what Yaakov Abinu is doing on top. So if he's going to go now and say, oh, Menashe, you're not getting the real blessing here, so move to the left. So now already that's embarrassing them. So he'd rather keep them in the same position with their head down, and he'll do what he has to do on top, unbeknownst to them. So Yaakov's teaching us a lesson in Derech Eretz, which is he does what he has to do, but he does it in the most, gentle manner, where he doesn't have to offend anybody, specifically his grandchildren. With that, we understand another question. The Pasuk says, Sikelet Yadav. That was the wisdom here. The wisdom is that instead of repositioning the children, the chokmah he used was to reposition his hands, not to embarrass. But the question that we answer as well is, it says, Ki Menashe HaBechor. He moved his hands because Menashe was the Bechor. What do you mean? On the contrary. It should say, since Menashe was the Bechor, he kept his hands straight out. Why is Menashe being the elder a reason to crisscross his hands? But based on the Noam Elimelech, we understand it. Since Menashe was the Bechor, he didn't want to embarrass him. So therefore, Sikelet Yadav. Why? Ki Menashe Bechor. So it wouldn't be nice to say to Menashe to move over to the left, because it would be a little humiliating. So because of that, he had to do the hands. That's the Noam Elimelech did it. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Rav Chaim ben Attar, in his commentary on the Torah, he has a different approach. I'm giving you different derachim to understand the Pesukim. The Torah is endless. You could actually probably make commentary on this one Pasuk from now until eternity, and then after eternity comes, they'll tell you, you just began to interpret the Pasuk, because the Torah is infinite. We're only going to tonight offer 5,000 interpretations to this Pasuk, and then we'll move on. What are we up to? I think this is number 3 we're up to. So you'll keep track. The Or HaKadosh says like this. The Torah prefaces to tell us Yaakov was going blind. So he couldn't see. So therefore, he doesn't know the position of Menashe and Ephraim. But he can assume that if Yosef is positioning them, he's probably going to put Menashe to his right and Ephraim to his left. This is conjecture, because according to the Aram HaKadosh, Yaakov is blind. So the conjecture would be, so fair logic would say that Yosef is going to position them according to the age. So Yaakov, knowing that he wants to give Ephraim the primary blessing, he knows he has to crisscross. So it says in the Pasuk, Siken et Yadav. With Chokhmah, with wisdom, with intellect, he switched, he crossed his hands. Why? Ki Menashe HaBechor. Because since Menashe is the Bechor, it's fair to him to assume that Menashe was on his right. And it was. He's the firstborn. And he can't see. So he assumes, since Menashe is the Bechor, he's probably on my right. And therefore, if I want to give the primary blessing to Ephraim, I'm going to have to cross over. Sikel et Yadav, ki Menashe HaBechor. Follow the Lord HaChaim HaKadosh. Rav Shimon Schwab, Zichrono Levracha, has a most beautiful interpretation to this event. He holds, he says like this, Yosef HaSadiq was blessed with what we might call the best of both worlds. Yosef was a spiritual giant, a man that studied Torah with his father for 17 years. Ben Zekunim, as the Targum explains those words, Bar Hakim, he was a brilliant, gifted, talented child. But Yosef also possessed a worldly side to him. Yosef was the consummate statesman. He was a man that dealt with people. He was the viceroy of Egypt. Obviously, he sat in meetings. Obviously, he dealt with governments, with ministers. He sat with the king. So Yosef, besides being the great Tamir Hacham that he was, but he was also out there. He wasn't limited to the Beit Midrash per se, but he also had his feet in the world. Of course, Yosef's feet in the world probably has a status of having our feet in the Beit Midrash, but the point is, he had also exposure to the world. His children, says Rav Schwab, Menashe and Ephraim inherited their father's traits. Ephraim was the learner. Ephraim inherited the spiritual side of Yosef. As a matter of fact, when Yaakov Abinu came down to Egypt for the last 17 years of his life, his Havruta was Ephraim. If you went to the Beit Midrash in Egypt, you'd see Yaakov sitting with his grandson Ephraim. They sat the whole day and learned. So Ephraim inherited that spiritual Torah side of Yosef, while Menashe was the more public figure. As you remember, Menashe was the aide to his father in the palace. I think we learned that the interpreter for Yosef when he was negotiating with his brothers was Menashe. So you see, Menashe found himself in the palace. He was involved in the worldly matters, he was involved in the politics, he was involved in whatever had to be governing the country. So now Yaakov Avinu is at a very critical moment here. It's a critical moment for his grandchildren, and it's a critical moment for Klal Yisrael. Because based on Yaakov's actions, he's going to send a very powerful and clear message to Klal Yisrael. By whom he gives the blessing to, that's going to show us who the priority of vocation is. Yaakov Avinu goes out of his way to put his right hand on Ephraim. In that action, Yaakov Avinu was sending a powerful message that Torah reigns supreme. That the lifeblood of our people is Torah. Ephraim is the Ikar. However,
viable nation must have at its helm lay leaders that are capable of governing a people, managing a community. You need lay people. You need businessmen. You cannot only have a theocracy of rabbis, of studying Torah. You need people that can get things done. People that are able to build. People that are able to manage. Of course you need the hachamim. And of course the lay leaders must be governed by the hachamim, through da'at Torah, through their advice and their counsel. But Yaakov Avinu was saying, you need menashehs in the world. But they're only second to Ephraim. But you know what? Says Rav Shimon Schwab, to emphasize the significance of both vocations, Rav Schwab writes, he specifically kept Menashe in his position. Because he wanted to emphasize that they're both good. In the position that they stood, Menashe was to the right. You need Menashe's in the world. When it came to the blessing, he crisscrossed his hand to show, but Torah reigns. But he did not want to move Menashe out of his position because Menashe is valuable. You need lay leadership in Klal Yisrael. You need people that are out there in the world making money, building, supporting, doing. After all, Ephraim without Menashe cannot exist. And therefore, Yaakov Avinu, according to Rav Shimon Schwab, when he blesses his grandchildren, the Pasuk says, Vaybarech et Yosef vayomar. That's quite strange. Vaybarech et Yosef, he's blessing Menashe and Ephraim. The explanation is when he saw Menashe and Ephraim, both of them equaled Yosef. Menashe and Ephraim equaled Yosef because they each one possessed one of the traits of Yosef. That when Yaakov's standing in front of his grandchildren, this is Yosef. Incidentally, you see the Yiridat HaDorot, you see how the generations decrease in greatness. Yosef was able to embody both. The next generation already was too difficult. There was no more Yosef. It's finished. That's over. You want to be Yosef, it takes two people now to be Yosef. Yeah, the next generation, it probably takes four people. In our generation, it probably takes 40 million people to be to value one day of Yosef's life. In any event, however you want to learn the Pesukim, according to Rav Schwab, Sikel et Yadav is the Chokhmah. In what Yaakov did was, he was sending a message to Klal Yisrael. Torah is the Ikar. Ephraim is the guy. But Menashe is also important. So he remains in his spot. However you want to learn, Rabotai, Yosef is not happy. Yosef is upset with what's going on over here. Not only is he upset, but he verbalizes his protest. And the Pasuk says, Vayar Yosef, Ki yashit abiv yad yemino al rosh Ephraim vayera be'enav. He wasn't happy. He was upset with it. Vayitmoch yad abiv lahasir otam me'al rosh Ephraim. So he tries to actually pull the hands of Yaakov away. Yosef tries to physically shift his father's right hand away. And he's protesting, Dad, in the next pasuk, Lo chen avi. Dad, it's not so. Ki zeh bechor, sim yeminecha al rosho. Yaakov Avinu, in a very sharp rebuke, answers his son two things. The Midrash writes that First he tells his son, whose hands you think you're moving over here? These are the hands that triumphed and subdued a heavenly angel. But you think you're just going to move these hands? So simple to move these hands. And number two, he tells him, this is what's written in the text. Vayomer, yadahti bini yadahti. He tells him, I know, my son, I know. The Midrash comments on the double language. Yaakov says, Yodeya ani et ma she'ata yodeya, vegam et ma she'incha yodeya. Oh, what a chastisement. Yaakov tells his son, Yadati beni yadati. Not only do I know what you know, but I also know what you don't know. Now, I know what you know. I know what's happening over here. I know what I'm doing over here. You think I'm a senile? I know that I'm giving the berakat there. I know what you know. And it's not conventional to do that, but I'm doing it because I know also what you don't know. Yadati mini yadati. What a musar. What a lesson. It's almost that things never change. Children always think that they know better than their parents. And the Torah is coming to tell you over here very clearly with Yaakov's reaction. No matter, regardless of how certain we may be of our correctness, of our convictions and perceptions, we must always defer to our elders. Parents know best. By the mere fact that they're older than us, they have the experience of life under their belt. The mere fact that they've been around, that they know how things work. The problem is children always think that they're smarter than their parents. Yeah, the elders aren't with it. And even if they might accord them respect because of their age, but the younger generation thinks that they're more enlightened than their parents. Especially in our technologically advanced society, where a child sees his parents struggling to try to program his cell phone. And you say, well, what do they know? They know anything. These old times, they don't even know how to use a computer. They don't even know how to put the batteries into the radio. What do these people know? So that adds to the arrogance of children to think that they're smarter and more wiser. And therefore they don't have to defer or listen to them. Yaakov Abinu is giving a lesson, and his words reverberate throughout history to every child. Yadati bini yadati. Famous words. I know what you know, and I know what you don't know. And you got to learn that. Yaakov Avinu was saying, I didn't put my hands haphazardly here. There was specific intent. Now I want to point out, Yosef's opinion was not just based on, you know, looking to contradict his father. It actually was based on sound reasoning. As a matter of fact, so sound was the reasoning that we'd have claims if Yosef wouldn't react. Yosef sees deja vu all over again here. Yosef says, I don't believe it. He says, I got into this whole mess because my father showed favoritism to the younger one instead of the older one. Because my father favored me above my older brother. This is what happened to me. Now it's going to happen again? We just finished it. We just resolved this. Now we're going to start it again in the second generation. Ephraim's going to get the main beracha, and then there's going to be a tumult, and then Menashe and Ephraim are going to start the... So Yosef He saw what happens when a father prefers the younger sibling. He was a victim of it. So now he's watching, Dad, no way! That's why Yaakov Yosef is so excited. That's why he levels such a protest. He says, Lo chen avi, under no circumstances. But again, Yadati bini Yadati, I know that also. I also know that logic. And I was right then. And I'm right now also. Maybe it's not the venue to quote Mark Twain, so you'll forgive me for bringing someone that doesn't have a zechut to be mentioned here. But he once said something to the order that when he was 25 years old, he thought his father was not with it, passé, behind the times, regressive, not really current. He says, and then when I got to the age of 30, I had a different view. I realized my father was progressive, was with the times, was ahead of the times, was smart, was more than current, was perceptive. So Twain says, it's amazing how much he learned in 5 years. A typical attitude of a child. That the child thinks he knows better. The Gemara in Megillah, on Daf Lamed Aleph, tells us a very important klal, a rule, when it comes to youth and elders. The Gemara says, if the elders tell you to destroy, and the youth tell you to build, listen to the elders and destroy. Because binyan ne'arim setira, v'stirat zekenim binyan. The Gemara says, the construction of youth is destruction. And the destruction of elders is construction. And the Gemara even brings proofs to this. Elders know better. She'al avicha v'yagedcha zekenecha v'yomru lach. Ask your father and he'll tell you, your elders, and they'll advise you. All the more so, Rabotai, that Yaakov was not only the father of Yosef, but he was his rabbi. And he wasn't only his rabbi, but he was the rabbi of the generation. So it's one thing to second guess your father. But there's a lesson over here that Yaakov was teaching his son. You cannot second guess the Gedolim. The great Hakamim of the generation, they have a gift. Through their studying of Torah, were they able to see things that others cannot. And even if it seems simple and obvious, and they say the opposite. But it's their vision, and it's their insights, and they have the call. And we must subjugate our opinions to their opinions. If somebody was able to see 50 feet or 50 meters away, he's able to, he has good vision, he can see 50 meters away the smallest things. So the person that can only see 20 meters away, he has to humble himself to that person. He can't see that far. Chachmei Torah are blessed with that foresight, we'll call it. And even if what they say seems very strange, and the majority opinion doesn't concur, their opinion is right. The Torah tells us, Lo tasur min ha-davar asher yagidu lecha yamin u'smol. We're talking about right and left tonight. The Pasuk says, do not sway from what they tell you, yamin u'smol. If they tell you your right is your left and your left is your right, the Gemara says you have to believe them. Tonight we understand this pasuk. That's exactly what Yaakov was telling Yosef. Your right is your left and your left is your right. I know what I'm doing. What are you talking about that? Lo tasum ra davar ashiri yaminu lecha. Yaminu small. Even if the rabbi argues on the directions, you listen to what he says because he knows. But I once heard an interpretation. How come they gave the example, even if they tell you your right is your left and your left is your right? How come they didn't say, even if they tell you north is south and south is north? I mean, it's the same point. They're telling you something that doesn't make sense to you, but you have to still accept it. Or they tell you, day is night and night is day. Why did they give the example, right is left and left is right? The answer is simple. Because north is north. And south is south. That those are stagnant. Those never change. And you're right. If a rabbi comes and tells you north is south, you tell him refuah shelema, because he's wrong. And if he tells you day is night and night is day, you also pray for him because that's fact. You can't argue on that. The Torah doesn't tell you have to be a fool. But right and left is subjective. Right and left can change. It depends where you're standing. My right is your left. My left is your right. So therefore we can argue to today, tomorrow, and say, this is right. You say, no, this is right. We're both right. So therefore, the Torah says when they tell you left is right and right, because that's subjective. That's depending where you're standing. That's from their vantage, they're telling you that this is the way it is. And therefore we must subjugate our da'at to the hachamim. As a matter of fact, many times the Hachamim would say things that defy the logic. But those that adhere to their dictums would eventually see the light. Maybe that's why if you look in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, it says, Ezehu Hacham Haro'eta Nolad. How come it doesn't say, Ezu Hakam Haro'eh Et Ha'atid? And that's the basic message of the Mishnah. Who's a Hakam? Somebody that can project. And that can see things before they happen, so to speak. That's able to, have foresight. He can forecast. So just say, Ezu Hakam Haro'eh Et Ha'atid. You can see the future. It doesn't say, Haro'eh Et Ha'nolad. You can see the birth. Nolad is the birth. It's the same concept. You can see the result of what's going to happen, the birth. You can see the consequence of actions, of time. But I heard an explanation like this. Birth, childbirth, is a dark situation that eventually leads to a light situation, to a good situation. During childbirth, the mother is screaming in pain. There's doctors running in and out. There's nurses running in and out. It's a critical moment. And it takes a chacham during that dark time to say, everything will be okay. Everything will be, as a matter of fact, in a few minutes, there's going to be a party over here. What are you talking about? Party over here? What's going on? There's machines. There's blood. This is a disaster. And a wise man comes in a few minutes, you're going to be dancing, you're going to be singing. What are you doing in this situation, dancing and singing in about 20 seconds? He's impossible. I don't know what he's talking about. Impossible. Can't be. Guy's washed up. And sure enough, in 20 seconds, the baby comes out. It's a boy. Hey! And everybody's happy. And the doctors are dancing. And the parents are dancing. And everybody's happy. Ezehu hacham haro'eh et hanolad. The Hacham is able to see the Nolad not after it's born. During the darkness, during the hard times, he's able to see the good. So he's predicting things and you say, what are you talking? Impossible. You're crazy. And you can't believe it. But sure enough, able to see through it. It's like the story that took place in the times of the first Beit HaMikdash. Hezkiah Melech was the king. Just to give you an example, Hezkiah Melech did not have a formal army. Sanherib had 185,000 soldiers surrounding the wall of Jerusalem. At any minute, Sanhedrin's armies were just going to barrel the wall down and attack. Hizkiah's advisors came to him and said, "We have no choice but to surrender. The proper thing to do is we take a white flag, put it over the wall, because it's going to be a bloodbath tomorrow." This was Erev Pesach. Hizkiah says, "No, we're good." His advisors said, "How are we good exactly? We don't even have an army. What's good here?" "No, we're fine. No, no problem." And Hizkiah goes, Erev Pesach, he brings Korban Pesach, and he sits the night Pesach, drinking the Arba Kosot, eating the Matzah, singing the Haggadah. And the people say, "Well, we have a leader over here that's dreaming. He's jeopardizing the safety of Klal Yisrael. Surrender before it's too late." In the middle of the Seder, don't interrupt the Seder. And sure enough, the next morning, Hizkiah and Klal Yisrael wake up, and they look over the wall, and they see 185,000 soldiers of Sennacherib died in their sleep. And the war was over without Hizkiah even having to shoot one bullet. He was predicting something that was impossible to predict, something that was illogical, something that didn't make any sense. And the skeptics were there saying, "Hizkiah, you're washed up. You might be a great rabbi, but you're not a military man. This decision should be made by the army." Hizkiah said, "Leave it alone, we're doing fine." Compare that to another situation that took place in the times of the second Beit HaMikdash. There, it was a reverse situation. There the Jews were in a good position against the Romans. The Jews were living in Jerusalem. They had 21 years of food supply. They had an army. The Romans were worn out. They were sieging Jerusalem for 3 years. It was cold. They were tiring. So they came to the chief rabbi, Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, and they said, "It's time to go to war against the Romans. We'll be able to take them." And Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai comes along and says, "No, we must surrender." "Surrender? What are you talking about?" "The rabbi, go back to the yeshiva. Go sit and study. Good luck to you. But you know, when it comes to fighting wars, what do you know about? This is a decision to the army. Surrender? What are you talking? There's no reason to surrender." And sure enough, Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, they snuck him out of the city, and he was able to deliver a surrender plea to Aspasianus. And as a result of that surrender, they were able to keep Yavne, which was the city of rabbis, which eventually, after the destruction, the city of Yavne was the city where Klal Yisrael rebuilt itself from. Everybody thought they were wrong for surrendering. If he didn't surrender, the Romans would have destroyed everything, including Yavne. Then there would be no hope for Klal Yisrael. So again, Hizkiah and his generation says what? Fight. Rabbi Yohanan and his generation says surrender. Both didn't make sense, but both were right in the end. Yamin semol, semol yamin. And maybe that's what the Gemara means. It says when Rabbi Yohanan was on his deathbed, right before he died, he says, "My dear students, bring a chair, bring a chair." "What a chair for?" He says, "I see Hizkiah, the king of Yehuda, that's coming down to greet me." That's what happened in Rabbi Yohanan's last moments. Hizkiah, the king of Yehuda, that lived years before him, came down to the room to escort Rabbi Yohanan to his final resting place. What does Hizkiah and Rabbi Yohanan have in common? Now we understand. They were both leaders of their generation. Hizkiah in the time of the first temple, Rabbi Yohanan in the time of the second temple. And both made decisions that defied logic. Hizkiah, instead of saying surrender, said fight. And Rabbi Yohanan, instead of saying fight, said surrender. And they were criticized. They were second guessed. And in the end, history proved that both those decisions were ingenious. And therefore let the two brilliant leaders escort each other to their final resting place. The Rambam, in his classic letter called Igeret Teman, a letter that he sent to the Jews of Yemen 700 years ago, he writes to them, and I'll translate it. He says, just like the blind man relies on the person with eyes to guide him because he knows he can't see, and just like the sick man relies on the doctor to prescribe him medicine because he knows he doesn't have wisdom in that field, so too the Amaris must depend on the scholar when it comes to religion, because this is not his expertise, because he does not have knowledge and understanding in this field. The problem is that everybody thinks they're an expert when it comes to religion. Everybody knows. Even though they never went to yeshiva, even though they never opened up a book, even though they can't find the book on the library, and they don't know if it's upside down or right side up, but they know. They know what it's supposed to be, and they know what was done, and how it's supposed to do, and what we did, and what we didn't do, and what the minhag is, and what the minhag is not. And they already, without any formal education, have no problem sitting on an education committee of a yeshiva. Or have no problem being on a advisory board to make decisions and spiritual decisions. It would almost be comical if you had rabbis on the board of the business. What do the rabbis know about selling bathing suits? So you're going to put, hey, this is a business over here, we manufacture bathing suits in Hong Kong, and we have advisory board, Rabbi so-and-so, Shlita, Gaon, what are we talking about? These are selling bathing suits, what do they know about selling bathing suits? They don't know how to wear a bathing suit, forget about selling them. So just as comical as that would be, it's just as comical to have a lay leader to enter a domain where he has no understanding. You're excused, please. It's my fault that I'm not understanding you good. After the class, I'll sit with you to understand. I want to give you the right time. Maybe I'm nervous, so I'm not understanding you. But you'll say it again, and I'll get you after. You see over here, Rabotai, that everybody has to know the expertise. They tell a mashal of a king. He decided one day to open up one of the galleries, the art galleries, in the middle of the city, and to bring artists to show off their work. And all the townspeople, the people in the metropolis came at night with their wives, and they're looking at, art connoisseurs. They're looking at things, and they're giving their opinion, it's very nice, the colors and the texture, and the art connoisseurs are. And they're all praising the king. Beautiful stuff. Great work. Unreal. And there happens to be a farmer that happened to be in town that day. He's a farmer by day and a drunkard by night. That's what he does. He drinks at night. He happened to be in the town. He finished drinking in the bar that night. He said, let me go to the gallery. They're all there. Some action. Let's see what it's worth. So he walks in. Right away they see him. They say this guy doesn't belong. And right away he makes his way to the king. And he says, you'll forgive me, but I have an opinion on some of these paintings over here. The king says, you have an opinion? So right away the security wants to take him. The king says, no, if he has an opinion, let's hear him. He says, for example, this picture of the drunk man, there was a picture of a drunk man. He's obviously, this artist does not know the first thing about drunk people. So the king says, why do you say that? He says, the guy's sitting on a stoop holding a glass of wine. A drunk man never holds his glass like that. It's too straight. He's drunk. It usually is tilted. It's usually on the floor. So security's ready to take the guy. The king says, hold it. The guy's got a point. It's not accurate. So he tells the artist, the king tells the artist, change that picture, this is wrong. And he tells the treasurer, give this man 1,000 rubles. The man says, 1,000 rubles, look at this, 1,000, you know how many squash he has to sell from the farm to make 1,000 rubles? This is a windfall. So now he's going to press his bet, and he says, well, you know, I've already, I have another criticism about another painting here. He says, okay, please go right ahead. He says, that picture over there of the farmer holding a sickle in his hand about to cut the wheat. He says, well, I got to be honest, the artist does have a great rendition of wheat. The wheat is perfect. As a matter of fact, I wish that I would have wheat in my field that look as beautiful and as healthy as the wheat in the picture. So that he has down pat. But it seems that he doesn't know what a sickle is. Because in the real world, a sickle is never as shiny as that one in the picture. It's usually rusty, it's usually used. You know, you have your gardener come. You never see a gardener's clippers totally silver. They're all black and there's all dirt on them. A sickle is never, it must be just, he copied a picture of a new sickle that he saw in the store, but they don't look like that in the field. The king says, you know, you're right. This is not accurate. Not 1,000 rubles. So the guy's rolling now. The guy became a connoisseur himself. And then he says, well, ready if, you know, you're taking my opinion seriously, I have one more thing to say about the third picture. That was the picture of the previous king that was sitting on the throne wearing a crown. So he says, the crown is wrong. The diamonds are not supposed to be in that formation. The king says, enough is enough. Now take him out and give him 100 lashes. The guy says, what are you talking about? What, you accept my opinion on the first two? If I'm right on the first two, why am I not right on the last opinion? He says, you're right on the first opinion because it takes a drunkard to know a drunkard. And therefore, praise be the painter who made a mistake in drawing a drunkard, because it means he doesn't know what a drunkard is. But you, I respected your opinion. It takes a farmer to understand the picture of a farmer. But that might have been your expertise, but you're not going to stand there and tell me that you have expertise on the settings of the diamonds of a crown of the king. That for sure is not in your domain. And therefore you deserve to be whipped. And that's the same thing when it comes to people. You have to know your expertise and you have to know exactly where your limitations are. Most people's limitations are past business. Past the business world, past making money, once you get to the religious area, we might know a little from learning a couple of pages here and there, attending some classes minimally, but when it comes to drawing an opinion in Torah, that can only be given by the hachamim that are sitting and studying and are reading. You can't just read one page of Gemara and all of a sudden now start giving opinions on what you think. You don't know enough to think, and therefore you must bow to the opinions of the scholars. Furthermore, there is another lesson we could learn, which is quite comforting. Based on what we're saying tonight, Menashe and Ephraim had two different roles. Menashe was the businessman, Ephraim was the learner. I saw a great halakha that's written in the Shulchan Aruch. Halakha. A legal opinion. Maran writes in Yoreh De'ah Siman Resh Mem Vav Halakha Aleph. He says, Kol Ish Mi Yisrael Hayav V'Talmud Torah. Everybody must learn. Everybody has an obligation to study Torah. Ben Ani, Ben Ashir, no matter what his economic situation is, rich or poor, no matter how healthy he is, Ben Shalem Begufo, Ben Baal Yisurin, no matter how old he is, no matter his age, Ben Bachur, Ben Zaken Gadol, he must find time to study Torah daily, in the morning and in the evening. And then Shulchan Aruch writes the following, Umi She'i Efshar Lo Lilmod. The person, for example, he can't learn. Why can't he learn? Either because Enu yodeya klal lilmod. He just doesn't know how to learn. O mipene hatirdot sheyesh lo. He's preoccupied. He's busy. So what do you think Maran says about this guy? A guy that doesn't have time to learn for whatever reason. I would expect Maran to say, Mi she'ev shalo lilmod, yelech legehinam. Finished. That's period. That's it. There's no excuse. You can't learn. That's it. You're eternally doomed. But it's a good thing I wasn't writing the halakha. Maran had a much more liberal opinion for this guy. He said, Yaspik la'acharim halomdim. Let him support those that are learning. V'techashev lo ki'ilu lomed be'atzmo. Interesting. And it'll be considered as if he's learning himself. So number two, tonight we learn another lesson. That it's possible to be a Menashe with the advantages of Ephraim. It's possible to be the worldly Jew, exposed, traveling, buying, selling, but he can still have all the advantages of Ephraim if he supports Torah. And he enables Ephraim to study, so already they become partners. The Hafetz Chaim says, but what is the good of such a partnership? What's going to happen, he says? Now, and he brings proofs to this. I'm not going to go into the proofs tonight, but there's solid proofs to what I'm going to tell you now. He says, after 120, when the Talmid Chacham goes up to his final resting place, so they're going to put him in a big yeshiva with, you know, kavod and glory and all that. He says, the supporter of that man is also going to be next to him. He gets like an easy pass. You know, he was a Menashe, but he gets the real estate of an Ephraim in Olam Abba. It's an amazing thing. So the Hafez Chaim says, well, what's it worth? They're going to put him in such a big yeshiva, but the guy's Amma artist. He don't understand anything. You know, it's like, take the richest guy in the world and tell him, oh, we're going to give you a big reward. We're going to put you in Panovich yeshiva in the top shiur. He's going to be sitting there. They're moving their thumbs up and down. And they're screaming all different things in Yiddish. You know, the guy sitting there has no idea. And they tell me, you're going to be here forever. Forever. Tell me the gay name, I'm better off. I don't know what they're talking about over here. So what's the benefit that they're going to put a rich businessman next to the rabbi he supported? And he's going to be sitting there, listening to the shi'ur, not understanding a word. So the Hafez Chaim says that his tradition is that they can infuse in that businessman wisdom as well. So you can understand it. To me, this is not fair. You forgive me for saying, I'm not saying that this is wrong. This is the way it is. But personal opinion, this is not fair. Because based on what we're saying tonight, a rich man can buy his eternity. So the poor man, he's got to earn it the hard way. He's got to learn and go. The rich man, of course, he has to be religious, but he can just write a check out to the yeshiva, and he goes up there, and they tell him, oh, they check his name, they verify his signature, and they tell him, okay, yeah, so you can go straight up. You're with the big rabbi. So I once heard, and I didn't see this written, but I heard from the grandson of the Hafetz Chaim, Rabbi Zaks once told me the following. He said his grandfather asked this question. And the Hafetz Chaim answered this question like this. Yeah, it's not fair. That's the question. It's not fair. So he says like this. That's why there's a special Yetzer Hara that goes into the head of the rich man and gives him reasons why he shouldn't give to the study of Torah. Don't think it's so easy. He has a special Yetzer Hara custom made to try to talk him out of giving. The rabbi comes to his office and you see the rich guy, well, not now. A black hat, these guys are kolel, I'm not interested in that. I don't give my money to whatever. They put poison in his brain not to give. So don't think it's so easy, he says. He has a special test. God's not going to make it so easy for him that he could spend his money and make a sound investment. But this guy, after 120, when he sees what he could have bought with his money, He bought an apartment in Florida that he only lives 3 Saturdays of the year he lives there. He bought a house, a summer house that he only lives 10 Shabbatot for the summer. He could have bought eternity, 10 billion Shabbatot. He's going to kick himself. He said, "Where all this money I had, I could have bought. And why didn't I give God? Because a black hat, because they're learning. I don't give learning. I don't give 20. He gave all silly excuses to himself. And they're going to laugh at him. "You fool, you fool. You thought you were making sound investments. You could have spent some money in support of Hakamim studying Torah. You would have been set for life." So the lessons that we learned tonight are twofold. Number one, Yaakov Avinu is telling us very clear. The vocation of Ephraim, Torah reigns supreme in Judaism. Torah is the ikar. Those that are fortunate to have their livelihood in Torah, in studying in the yeshiva, in teaching in the yeshiva, they're very lucky individuals. They're exactly the primary role of our, they're fulfilling the primary role of our people. And those that are fortunate to be the Menashehs of the world, they also are in the right position. Yaakov will not move Menasheh out of position to show him that he has proper standing as well. But only when he subjugates himself to Da'at Torah. And now we learned that even Menasheh is able to live like Menasheh in this world, but benefit from the life of Ephraim in the next world. And that is by supporting. And that is by giving investment and partnering up with those that study. Something that you should think about. Find a scholar. Now, this is an interesting question. Could you retroactively buy the scholar's Torah? Halakha says you can't. So you have to find the up-and-coming scholar. Well, somebody that you think your investment will pay you off, make a deal with him. Give him parnasa to allow him to learn with a clear head. You're buying yourself olam haba. You know, you can't buy Walmart today what it was 30 years ago. You can't call your stockbroker and say, "Give me Walmart in 1973 when it was $2 a share." Those days are over. You want to buy today, you can buy today. You can't retroactively buy a stock. But going forward, you're able to invest. And therefore, people should think like that. That's a very, very prudent thing. If you're concerned about the long term, this is something that we should think about. Etz ha'im hi l'ma'azikim ba v'tomechei ha'me'ushar. Hachamim compare those that support Torah. The Torah becomes an Etz Chaim. It's a tree of life. There was somebody once drowning in the river. Chas v'shalom, bar minnan. So they threw in a log. So he grabbed onto the log. The log saved his life. The fellow said, "Look, I saved the log from drowning." The Tamu Tipesh, "You saved the log from drowning? The log saved you from drowning. You're looking at it backwards." The pasuk says, "Etz chayim hi l'ma'azikim ba." The supporter of Torah is not holding up Torah. Torah is holding up him. He's holding Torah. He thinks he's supporting Torah. On the contrary, he's holding on to a buoy. It's an etz chayim. He's holding on to a piece of wood. The wood is keeping him afloat. He's a bigger beneficiary than the one that received it. V'tomechei ha'me'ushar. And those that support are fortunate. They're lucky. Because they'll benefit in this world and they'll benefit in the world to come. And that's our lesson tonight. To become decent menashes. To know our limitations. To have subjugation to the Da'at Torah, to the Hakamim. To accept their rulings, even if they don't seem fit to us. I once met a businessman. he was watching a tournament, a golf tournament. And Tiger Woods was up, and he teed off 300 yards. The ball was on the fairway, and the fellow comments and says, he should use the 6-iron now. So I looked at him very, very shockingly. I said, you're going to give an opinion? Who are you to give an opinion what Tiger Woods should use? The extent of your golf career is miniature golf. So what gives you the audacity to even give an opinion what club he should use? It's ludicrous. Now, if Arnold Palmer would give an opinion, it's okay, he has a right to give an opinion. You know, he earned his stripes. And then I started to understand that that's everybody's opinion when it comes to religion. When a rabbi makes a statement or a ruling, so everybody thinks that they already, you know, I don't think so. You don't think so. It's such expertise. Go make bathing suits. What do you know about this subject? You don't know the first thing about it. The rabbi's sitting in the, steeped in learning his whole life. You're going to come now, you know, over a cup of coffee and say, no, I don't think so. Who are you? What do you even know? It's a joke. You don't want your ass. Audacity. Recognize your expertise. And that's what Yaakov told his son, Yadati b'ni yadati. He says, don't protest so fast against your old father. I know exactly what I'm doing. I know what you know, and I know what you don't know. That's the lesson. She'al avicha v'yagetcha.
זכנך ויאמרו לך.